I'm going to go back down. I'm going to go back to Genesis 47, the last paragraph, just so we can get a quick refresher. So, and when the time drew near that Israel must die, so Israel, Jacob, he called his son Joseph to him. If now I have found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt. Pay attention to that. But let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place. He answered, I will do as you have said. And he said, swear to me. And he swore to him. Then Israel bowed himself upon the head of his bed. All right, so chapter 48. After this, Joseph was told, behold, your father is ill. So he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And it was told to Jacob, your son Joseph has come to you. Then Israel summoned his strength and sat up in his bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you. I'll make you a company of peoples and will give this land to your offspring after you for an everlasting possession. And now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are. And the children that you fathered after them shall be yours. They shall be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. As for me, when I came to Padan, to my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan on the way, when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath. I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. All right, so this is just the blessing being given to Joseph's sons. Remember, he had two sons when he was in Egypt. And basically, he's being told those two sons are included in the promise, in the blessing of their siblings, or they have of the descendants of Israel. So these two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, even though they were born of an Egyptian woman, and in Egypt, they are considered Israelites. Verse 8, when Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, who are these? Joseph said to his father, they are my sons, whom God has given me here. And he said, bring them to me, please, that I may bless them. Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age, so he could not see. So Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your offspring also. Then Joseph removed them from his knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. And Joseph took both Ephraim and his right hand toward Israel. Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and he brought them near to him. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the hand of Ephraim, who was the youngest, and his left hand on the hand of Manasseh, crossing his hands, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, the God before whom my father Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the boys. And in them let my name be carried on in the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac. Let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. So God is blessing these people again. These are not second-hand or second-rate descendants of Israel. These are going to be the Israelites as well. And there's a whole procedure he does with blessing with the hands. He said, this is on my right hand and the left hand, and crossing his hands over. And it's explaining basically, the one he blesses with his right hand is going to be the firstborn. The one he blesses with his left hand is going to be the secondborn. But it's it's interesting that it goes into details. It says, this person was standing here, and at his left hand was at this guy who was at the right hand of this, and then he crossed his hands over, and he did this. That. It's like, okay. I mean, it's some cool details, but I would have to draw it out. Verse 17, 48 verse 17. When Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, and he took his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, not this way, my father, since this one is firstborn, put your right hand on his head. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people and shall be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his offspring shall be a multitude of nations. So he blessed them that day, saying, By you, Israel will pronounce these blessings, saying, God will make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. Thus he put Ephraim, so not the firstborn, before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I'm about to die, but God be with you. But God will be with you and bring you again to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I given to you rather than to your brothers one mountain slope that I took from the hand of the Amorites with my sword and with my bow. So again, the hand crossing thing, it's just to show that Israel is blessing not the firstborn, but the secondborn. And I assume that this is something that comes from God, something that God has revealed to Israel to do this thing. You'll notice that this is a pattern in Genesis so far. So a lot of times you'll have the firstborn son. Esau was the firstborn son. Cain was the firstborn son. Where you have the firstborn son, and the assumption is that the firstborn, he's the one who gets the best blessing. And for the culture, for standardized practice, that's true. But God continues to make exceptions, and God continues to bless the person who wouldn't normally have the birthright. And now, if you wanted to make a mini sermon out of this, you can say that this is the way that that God blesses his children, because Jesus is called the firstborn from the dead. Obviously, Jesus is the only Son of God in that sense. But we are adopted children of God as well, and God continues to bless us as though we are his firstborn. He brings us into heaven, he gives us royal lineage, all that good stuff. So God regularly takes people who otherwise wouldn't deserve a blessing, and he blesses them anyways. And this is a pattern. God upsets the cart, as it were. He doesn't always do things in the way mankind's wisdom would expect him to do. There's a couple of phrases in the Bible where he says, your way or his ways are higher than our ways. And we don't understand everything that he does. So this is just another example of the not firstborn son being given a blessing that he doesn't by his birthright deserve. And if you'll remember, this happened with Jacob and Esau as well. So this is, Jacob wasn't supposed to be blessed, because he wasn't the firstborn, but God gave him the blessing anyway. All right, chapter 49. Then Jacob called his sons and said to him, "Gather yourselves together that I may tell you what has happened, or what shall happen to you in the days to come. Assemble and listen, O sons of Jacob. Listen to Israel, your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and my firstfruits and my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. Unstable as water, you shall not have preeminence. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul come not into their counsel. O my glory, be not joined to their company. For in their anger they killed men, and their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob. I will scatter them in Israel." So this is interesting. It says, the section in my Bible says, Jacob blesses his sons. And so far, it's not really good. Reuben, he says, "Hey, Reuben, you're pretty good. But you're unstable, and my soul is not going to be with you." And then Simeon and Levi, "Yeah, you guys are violent and wrathful, and your violence is a curse." So far these blessings don't sound too good. Verse 8, "Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down, crouched as a lion, and as a lioness. Who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples, binding his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He has washed his garments in wine, and in his vesture in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, his teeth are whiter than milk." It's an odd conversation to have with dad on his deathbed, and he's describing your teeth and your eyes and all this other stuff. But you have to understand that a lot of this is not just Jacob rambling, but this is a prophetic thing. And if you understand the people who descends, can you think of anybody important that descends from Judah, the line of Judah? Christ, yeah, and David as well. So if you're thinking about who descends from where, Jesus is from the lineage of Judah. David is from the lineage of Judah. So Judah's blessing kind of, I mean, you have to squint to understand it. I'm sure there's commentaries written about it, but it's, if you understand that Jesus is coming from this lineage, it makes sense that this is the blessing given to Judah and not to Simeon and Levi, for example. All right, verse 13, Zebulun gets one sentence. Zebulun shall dwell at the shore of the sea, shall become a haven for the ships, and his border shall be at Sidon. Issachar is a strong donkey crouching between the sheepfolds. He saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, so he bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant of forced labor. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls backward. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. Poor Dan. I mean, keep in mind again, these Joseph's brothers were kind of murderers. So, I mean, in addition to trying to kill Joseph, they did kind of murder a bunch of people. Verse 19, raiders shall raid Gad, but he shall raid at their heels. Asher's food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal delicacies. Well, that's nice. Naphtali is a doe let loose that bears beautiful fawns. Okay, that's sweet too. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a spring. His branches run over a wall. The archers bitterly attacked him, shot at him, harassed him severely, yet his bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile. By the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Interesting. His bow remained unmoved, his arms remained agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. And in this translation, it has the shepherd and the stone of Israel are both capitalized. So those are, by the way, terms that are used to refer to God. And you may recall in the New Testament, the good shepherd and the cornerstone or the capstone. These are the stones Jesus is referred to as the stone.
The Ebenezer.
Maybe not the Gethsemane. Gethsemane is also a stone. It's an important stone. It's a stone that's used to crush the olives. This concept of the stone, the shepherd, if you're drawing connections in your mind, that's probably the right place to go. Verse 25, by the God of your fathers who will help you. Did I skip two pages? Yes. By the God of the fathers who will help you, by the Almighty who bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb, the blessings of your father are mighty beyond the blessings of my parents, up to the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the brow of him who was set apart from his brothers. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf in the morning devouring the prey and at the evening dividing the spoil. Which is funny because all you've heard about Benjamin so far is he's just the little kid who's tricked. Yeah, I'm like, I don't know. It's interesting to think about. That's Benjamin's blessing. It's not what you would predict. Verse 28, all of these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with a blessing suitable to him. Then he commanded them and said to them, I am to be gathered up to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Malapah to the east of Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a buying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And there I buried Leah in the field and the cave that is in it. Were bought from the Hittites. When Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. That's a sweet way to think about it. He was gathered to his people. You remember chapters and chapters ago, this transaction where Abraham buys this field and this cave, and they're still using it. This is the burial place for Abraham's family. Chapter 50, then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for it, for that is how many are required for the embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. And when the days of weeping were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found favor in your eyes, Please speak in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, I'm about to die in my tomb, that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan. There you shall bury me. Now, therefore, let me please go and bury my father, then I will return. And Pharaoh answered, go up and bury your father, as he made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father. When he went up with all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as the household of Joseph, his brothers, his father's household, only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floor at Etad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with very great and grievous lamentation. And he made a mourning for his father 7 days. When the inhabitants of the land of the Canaanites saw the mourning of the threshing floor of Etad, they said, this is a grievous mourning by the Egyptians. Therefore the place was named Abel Mizraim. It is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave in the field of Machpelah to the east of Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite he possessed as a buying piece. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. So his father is buried back here in the cave, and pay attention later on when we get to the Exodus that they're carrying the bones of Joseph out with him, because they're going to bury him there as well. Because even though they're sojourning, it means they're temporarily living in Egypt. Egypt is not the promised land. Goshen, as nice as it is not the promised land. The promised land is in Canaan, which would later would be Israel or Jerusalem.
The burial preparations, the funeral preparations, were very elaborate. Mm-hmm. Do you think that his sons were attempting to make up in some way for their behavior during his life?
I'd like to believe that his sons had, at this point, seen the errors of their way and repented. I don't know that they're necessarily trying to make up for, that could be part of it, try to make up for the evil that they had done. But I think that maybe they've legitimately turned over a new leaf. And in the previous chapters, when Joseph is talking to them, Joseph is talking to them, they think that God is cursing them for the evil that they've done. So I would like to think that they've learned their lesson, although that could be a part of it, that they could be trying to make up for that. But part of it also is that at this point, Israel / Jacob is a very prominent figure. He's the father of the second most powerful man in all of Egypt, and the singular man responsible for Egypt being as wealthy as it is. This would be like, if you want to compare it to something, it would be a royal funeral. It would be the father of the king, basically, is dying. Because
he was well thought of in Egypt. He could have been buried like a pharaoh in Egypt.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that could have happened. That probably was the expectation of what would happen, because they moved to Egypt, and Joseph at this point had been living in Egypt long enough that by many people he was considered an Egyptian, even though he came from Canaan. What I'm not sure about is it talks about embalming. And I don't know, maybe the embalming was to transport his body, but as far as I know, I mean, there's burial spices that are used for kind of the Jewish burial rites, but embalming isn't the practice as I understand it. The practice as I understand it, and this changed over the years, there's different practices, is a lot of times what you would do is you would have a tomb, and this is what they did with Jesus, is they would lay him out in a tomb, and they would basically leave the tomb for a year or so. And when they came back, everything but the bones were the only thing remaining of the body. So they would leave the body kind of in the open until nothing but the bones were left. They would take the bones, and then they would put them in a kind of communal burial place. There would be, I think I saw a diagram that they had where basically you would, it's going to sound crass, but it's not. How a garbage chute works, where you kind of got a carved area and it slopes down, that you kind of put all the bones in the same sort of pit, I guess to say, and all the bones of the family go into the pit. So, but then again, that's more, that's a burial rite that's kind of done in the time of Jesus. Specifically in the time of Jesus, there's a period of about 20 years after Jesus' death where the burial rite was different. It was unique. And basically you do the same things. You would allow the body to decompose until just the bones were left. You'd gather up the bones and you'd put them in a stone vessel, like a jar or a carved box or something like that. It was called an ossuary. And while normally this would be extremely expensive and absurd to do this sort of thing, my understanding is at the time after Jesus' resurrection and ascension, there was basically an abundance of these chunks of stone from the quarries, from the Romans expanding the area. And because they had this, for this brief period of a couple of decades, the common burial rite for a lot of, you know, mid to high range, individuals was that they would be put in their own ossuary. This is why we have the ossuary of Caiaphas, the high priest. It's got his name inscribed on it. And the reason we know that it's not a different Caiaphas, who's also a different high priest, is because they were only doing ossuaries for that couple decades following after the ascension of Jesus. So this guy would have died in this brief period of time where they would have had this unique burial rite, after which they just didn't do that, and before which nobody could afford to do that. So because of the timeline and the burial practices, this is why we know that the ossuary of Caiaphas that we've dug up is the same Caiaphas, the high priest, that we have in the Bible. So in this case, when it's talking about the embalming, I don't know of any Israelite practice that would specifically include embalming. You know, Egyptian practices would include embalming. The mummification process is intended to preserve the body, the skin, the physical structure. The organs would be placed in a jar. But the physical structure, the skin and everything, like, I don't want to say, not taxidermy, but I don't like formaldehyde or something, where you actually want to preserve the soft tissue. That's what embalming does. And the examples I see of the Jewish kind of Israelite rites, they didn't try to preserve the soft tissue. They let it return to the earth, and then they kept the bones in a certain place. So when it specifically says embalming here, it makes me think, I wonder if this was kind of an Egyptian burial practice. But then rather than burying him in Egypt, Joseph insisted that he was buried in Canaan instead. So I wonder if it was kind of a mashup of Egyptian and Israel. But yeah, I think he absolutely, if he probably, he would have had his own pyramid, basically. It wouldn't have been a big thing, but you know, a 10-foot high pyramid. I imagine that he probably would have had some sort of burial mound structure like that because he was a prominent enough figure. Yeah, so there is a pyramid for Joseph that they found, that they dug up, although his body isn't there for a reason that we'll understand later. There is a statue that we tend to think depicts Joseph that's in, you can go into the pyramid, or you could have when it wasn't busted down. But yeah, for Israel, yeah, he would have, I mean, his body was returned to Canaan, so that's why there's no, as far as I know, there's no pyramid to Joseph, to Israel, or to Jacob/Israel in Egypt. Anyways, a lot of stuff to consider. I'm not the expert on this. I probably am wrong on a bunch of this stuff, but when I hear embalming, I'm not sure that I know of Israelite practices of embalming. That makes me think more of Egyptian stuff. And there's definitely some Egyptian stuff going on, like when Joseph is talking about his cup that he uses for divination, or that he puts in Benjamin's pack, he says, don't you know that this is the cup that I use for divination? That's not an Israelite thing. That would be an Egyptian thing. That would be an Egyptian practice. So I wonder how much of that is bleeding over. All right, where are we in the text? I'm not paying attention to the time. I probably should. Oh, we got time. Okay. All right.
Verse
22. Where are we at? Verse 15? So chapter 50, verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, it may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for the evil that we did to him. So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sins because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgressions of the servants of the God of your father. That's interesting. I don't remember reading that in the text anywhere. It's almost like they just made this up. They made up this command. Joseph's going to kill us now. We better say the dad said to forgive us. All right.
The brothers really haven't changed all then.
So they haven't changed all. Yeah, they are tricky. It's nice to have these flawed characters. It makes me believe that they might actually be real. All right. Forgive the servants, the transgressions of the servants of God, your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God?" So he doesn't respond as though, okay, dad says to do this. I guess I'll listen to this. So their trick wasn't even necessary. "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." This is a wonderful verse. It's an excellent thing to keep in mind, that even though people are doing evil to each other, this is why we can forgive even evil people. Verse 21, "So do not fear, I will provide for you and for your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Let me see something. You know something interesting here? They say that we are your servants. They never say that they're sorry. I don't know that they ever explicitly repent either. And this was an argument I got in with some people for the past couple of weeks over whether you have to wait until somebody says that they're sorry before you forgive them. And in this case, I don't see it. But the concept of Joseph's forgiveness is basically, he says, look, either I forgive you or I act like I'm in the place of God. Am I in the place of God? Is it my job to act out God's vengeance upon you? Later on in the Bible, it says, "Vengeance is mine, says the Lord." So we know that that's not the case. So in this case, forgiveness is not a response to repentance. In this case, forgiveness is him saying, "I am not your judge, and I am going to not try to cling to that authority. I am not going to pretend to be your judge. What you have is between you and God, between you and me. Maybe not we're square, but I will love you, I'll provide for you. Do not fear." In other words, "I'll provide for you and your little ones." Comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Verse 22. "So Joseph remained in Egypt and his father's house. Joseph lived 110 years, and Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation. The children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were counted as Joseph's own. And Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land that he swore to Abraham, bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.'" Remember, the promised land, this phrase, this is where it's bringing up. Verse 25, "Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, 'God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here.'" Keep that in mind. Verse 26, "So Joseph died being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt." So again, this is not probably the Israelite practice. This sounds more like the Egyptian practice. That's it. That's Genesis. We did it, Genesis chapter 50. Yeah, I don't know why I expected the sentence to continue. So Joseph died. Being 110 years old, they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. And then other things happened later on in the story with his bones and with the descendants of Israel. But that is the history starting from the creation of the universe, Adam and Eve, going all the way through to Joseph and Joseph's offspring in Egypt. So we have this entire, if you want to say, an entire backstory is all set up for the events that happened. The rest of the books in the Old Testament deal with the Israelites. But you know now who the Israelites are. They're the descendants of Israel. And not just the Israelites, but also the descendants of the other people around Israel. So it was important to get this backstory to say, where did the Edomites come from? They came from Esau. So who was Esau? Well, Esau was related to this. This was excellent. Those of you who remember, we actually started Genesis because we were going through. I was saying the kids get all the fun stories. The kids get all the David and Goliath, Samson, Daniel in the lion's den, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery, fiery furnace. They get all those fun stories. So I was going through all of them, and we went through Genesis 1 to go through the creation story. And if you go through Genesis 1, you have to go through Genesis 2, because that shows how the details of the creation of mankind, Adam and Eve. Well, if you've got Adam and Eve, you've got to see what happened to them in Genesis 3. That's what happened to them. Well, that's kind of depressing that, you know, they sinned and they got kicked out of the garden. Surely that's not the end of the story. So before you know it, we're in Genesis 50 today. So 50 chapters of Genesis in less than a year. And I think we were able to touch on a lot of important things that were worth talking about. So with that, are there any questions or comments about either the story today or any of Genesis that we went through you want to talk about? So the first five books of the Bible, pop quiz, what are the first five books of the Bible called? And yes, sometimes they're called the Torah, but what's another name for the first five books of the Bible?
Pentateuch.
The Pentateuch. What does Pentateuch mean? Or Penta is five, well, it means like the five books, basically. The Pentateuch is written by Moses, a character that we haven't been introduced to yet, but we will if we continue in Exodus. It's written down by Moses. Now, you'll notice that Moses wasn't alive for a lot of this history. For all of Genesis, in fact, Moses wasn't even there. And this is, I mean, and God preserved his history at this point. The Bible doesn't say specifically how. We know that there is a tradition of telling stories and passing down this information. I don't know if there was a writing system or how that worked. But that God also preserved these. We don't have to worry about, well, Moses was just writing down, you know, kind of fables that his people made up over the time. It's a fictional history. Because the reality is that Moses was a prophet. God spoke to him directly. In fact, face to face is a pretty significant portion of Moses' interaction. So if you're worried about Moses maybe wrote down the history wrong because he wasn't there for the history, you have to keep in mind, one, that the history was preserved by the people who came before him, and two, that the history was preserved in a divine way by God, who gave Moses the details. After all, how could Moses write about what happened in Genesis chapter 1 when literally Adam didn't even exist until the very end of Genesis chapter 1? How could Moses write about something that happened when nobody was there? Well, because God told him. God was the only one who was there for creation, so of course God informed Adam and Eve, and God told Moses to write these things down. But yeah, so the first five books are often connected together. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Genesis, the word Genesis means to generate, like regenerate, to create, to give birth. This is the first book. This also talks about the beginning, the birth, the beginning. It's interesting if you read the Greek for Matthew chapter 1, the first few words in the Greek are, this is the Bible of the Genesis of Jesus Christ. I don't think it was a mistake that Matthew wrote, this is the Bible of the Genesis of Jesus Christ. If you read the English, it'll say, this is the book of the generations of Jesus Christ, but the actual Greek words are, this is the Bible, the Biblos of the Genesis of Jesus. I don't think that's a coincidence. This is one of the places where I disagree with the official CPH commentary on this material. Gibbs is a brilliant commentator, but I insist that Matthew knew what he was doing when he knew that his book was going to be the first book in the New Testament, and he connected it back to Genesis and the first book in the Bible. So Genesis is about the generation, the creation of people, and ultimately, when you get to this point, Genesis 50, this is the creation of Israel, the Israelites, who will be our main characters for the next couple of books. Exodus means to exit, to leave. Well, this is kind of the main thing that happens in Exodus, is that they leave Egypt. Genesis, Exodus. Leviticus refers to the Levites in the Levitical law. So the descendants of Levi will have these specific laws for how to do temple stuff. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers is a horrible name for the book because it sounds so boring, and it's really not. Numbers, yes, there are numbers in the book. I think that there's years and there's like generations and stuff that are counted. But the original title for the book of Numbers in Hebrew is Into the Wilderness. So if you're wondering what happens in the book of Numbers, they come out of Egypt in Exodus. They're in the wilderness a bit, And then in the book of Numbers, it's more about them in the wilderness. So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, or wilderness. Deuteronomy. Deutero means second. Nomos means law. So it's the second giving of the law. So you're going to see a lot of repetition from the laws given on Mount Sinai and the Levitical laws. So those are the first five books of Moses. And then after that, you have other books that talk about the prophets and the judges and Psalms that David writes and wisdom literature like the Proverbs and lamentation literature. But for these first five books, you kind of have a combination of history and the giving of laws, like the prescription of thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt do this on this day and wash these bowls with this blood and this oil or whatever. So that's, we could keep going through this. I definitely think we should at least go through Exodus. But since we finished Genesis, since we finished a book, I'm going to ask, would you like to continue the story in Exodus, or is there something else specifically you want to study? Are we good with Exodus, or you want to, okay. I know everybody wants to, let's do Revelation, we cannot do Revelation until we've done Daniel, and then after we've done, we can't do Revelation until we've done Daniel, we have to do Hebrews first, and then we've already done Hebrews, by the way. That's in the New Testament. So that means we can do Exodus and Leviticus, or Leviticus and Deuteronomy, because we can do Hebrews. So it's all complicated. The books are written in order, but if you want to study them to the best, if you want to understand them the best, it's actually best. I recommend to most people, you start in the New Testament. Start with Matthew or John and learn about this Jesus guy. Then you go back to the Old Testament and you see all the things that talk about Jesus, the shepherd, the rock of Israel, all this really cool stuff. You're like, hey, I know that guy. I know who that's talking about. That's the Jesus guy from later on. This good shepherd, the Psalm 22, the crucifixion and stuff. You know, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall love. I know about a good shepherd. So you can read the Bible cover to cover. That's fine. But for the sake of studying it, I prefer sometimes reading it out of order. If you want to understand everything, all the fancy stuff going on in Revelation, first of all, you need a doctorate. No, it's good to have a commentary, though, to see what all the things are referencing. But second of all, you basically have to understand the rest of the Bible first, specifically all the prophetic stuff. With that, let's close with the doxology, and we'll continue with Exodus next time.